So, so machen wir noch den Record. The voice button becomes the printing rule of the outline. So the most important thing is what we're going to talk about in the course. It's going to be too small.
Giuseppe, could you upload this as a PDF so we don't have to go to the website every time we want to check this?
Sure, I'll do that. Okay, probably not very likely, but I cannot see the phone
case. Dude, I have my glasses on.
Okay. Okay, so the important thing is that we're going to go over the various grammatical structures that we're using in Celtic. That's the main goal of this course. I'm not going to assume you know any country geography, so I'm going to introduce everything we need in this course. The only thing I will assume you know is some basic ideas of the use. So whatever you see related to the quantitative resources that's fun for our purposes. So we're going to start today with the manifolds, then we go to the country transport and the week. Next week we do some quantitative manifolds. Nervous theorem to talk about manifolds. We'll briefly do integrational manifolds, and then we're going to get to the main thing I want to show you, which is Fabian boundaries. Values, kinds of Fabian boundaries to use, and in particular, we're going to cover the ones we can use here. And depending on how much time we have left, we may see some other things, such as the round homology or the round manifold. But that really depends on how the course, because there are shorter lectures than we had last year, and I have to. The rest is pretty much the same. We're going to have tutorials, we're going to do homeworks. I'll let you read the rest of yourself. There's really nothing strange. I guess the only thing is also part of the interview. There's one thing you can do is read through a book chapter or some article, and you are welcome to suggest which chapter of this book or which chapter you'd like to look at. But also, you have the option of just coming up with some idea of something else you want to do. Thinking about the interview, you just let me know and try to do it in the next time. We don't see people as in life, as long as that goes. Everything else is pretty much the same. There are some references here. Most people are going to reference my.
Could you please check if the microphone is turned on?
Oh, so it was off.
Thank you.
Okay, so I hope you kind of heard what I said so far. So there are references here other than the lecture notes. A book that I really like is Foundations of Mechanics. So you can look at chapter 1 and 2 for the differential geometry stuff, 3 and 4 for symplectic manifolds and Noether's theorem. And Introduction to Smooth Manifolds is also another one I like. I like this one better, the first one, because it's free and everyone can get it. But the other one is also good. I don't have any specific references for the fiber bundle stuff because I'm just piecing together things from lots of different places. If I come up with something later on when we get to the point, I'll let you know. I think this is it for what I had to tell you right now. So are there any questions before we start? Okay, so today we're going to start with introducing manifolds. Now, you've probably seen a bunch of these things already, and in fact, you're going to see them again today, if that's not happened already in the gravitational physics course, if you're taking that. So a few of the things we're doing, they're covered also in other courses, but I feel like it's a good thing to see things in a bunch of different ways. It helps with understanding. I remember when I was doing my undergrad, in the same 2 weeks, we did topology in two different courses, and it was redundant, but also helped us understand. So hopefully that's going to happen here as well. So our goal for this lecture is to define manifolds, and the goal of manifolds is the following. We're trying to formalize an idea. And this idea is I put it in quotes because it's a vague thing at this point, an n-dimensional smooth shape. So this is something that's vague and we can sort of understand. So we have a notion of what a two-dimensional shape is. We can talk about a sphere and we can think of it as being two-dimensional, or a cylinder, and I'm talking about just a shell for both the cylinder and the sphere, or a piece of paper. And something being smooth, we can just think of it as just being something like this. It doesn't have any kinks. If I do this, it's not smooth anymore because it has this weird thing here. We would like to formalize this thing without using pieces of paper. So first of all, we need to figure out what it means for something to be n-dimensional. Why is the sphere a two-dimensional object? Why do we agree on this fact? Any ideas?
We need two parameters to...
Yes. We can, using two parameters only, we can describe points on the sphere. And if we use three, there's too many points. If we use one, we cannot do it. So it's at least two parameters, and in fact, two parameters is enough. So our idea for n-dimensional is that we can use n parameters to describe this shape. To make this more formal, we're going to say that n-dimensional means that we can locally describe our shape as if it was a Rn. In other words, the reason why a sphere looks is a two-dimensional thing is that if you really look very close to the surface of the sphere, it looks like it's a plane. You don't really realize it's a sphere because you don't see the whole big thing of it wraps around itself. That's the big difference between a sphere and a plane. The plane, you can just keep going and you keep going, but the sphere, if you keep going, eventually you loop around. So locally, they really look the same, the sphere and a plane. So that's the idea of being an n-dimensional thing. The smooth thing is a bit more complicated to do, and we need to be more formal to define this. To formalize the idea of something that's an n-dimensional local thing, we're going to use the notion of a chart. So we say that the chart on M, where M is some set, it's just a set of points that we want to give a shape to. So it's going to be a pair of two things. So it's a pair U phi, where U is some subset of M. That's a local part. Because we want to describe locally things, we just want to look at a little piece of this object. And maybe this piece is the whole thing, but in general, it's going to be something smaller. And phi is a map from U to Rn. So locally looks like Rn means that we can map some smaller section of the whole set to Rn in a certain way. We want this map to have some properties, so such that phi is injective, which means it's one-to-one. It maps different points in U to different points in Rn. And additionally, phi of U is open in Rn. Those are the only requirements. If we have this, then M locally looks like Rn, in the sense that the subset U looks like Rn. The reason why is that phi is injective, which means that if we look at phi, it maps to some subset of Rn, and we can invert this. So injective means that we can define phi to the minus 1, which goes from phi of U to U. This is well defined, so we can invert it. If we have an invertible map between two sets, they are essentially the same thing. We have a way of translating things from one to the other and back. And the reason why we want this to be open is that if phi of U is open, it looks like Rn. If it's not open, then we have problems because now it has some structure that's different from Rn. Rn is an open set. It doesn't have a boundary, among other things. If we have phi of U being closed, for example, it could have a boundary, and then what we're doing doesn't make sense anymore. You can still do it. You see this at one of the tutorials. And then you define something different, which is a manifold with boundary. But right now, we're not allowing for that. OK, so that's our first definition of a chart. Does it make sense to everyone? Yes?
Saying these two things means that phi is invertible?
Phi is invertible, you just need to be injective. Being injective is the same as being invertible. Because if it's injective, it's one-to-one. Every point maps to a different point, and then you can reverse this operation. Usually, you say that invertible is injective and surjective. The reason why is that if I say phi goes from U to Rn, no one says that it maps to all of Rn, so you cannot invert it from all of Rn to U. But injective is enough to say that if you restrict the inverse to the image, you can invert it. So technically, injective is enough because the codomain of a function is actually a weird and not very well defined thing. Good question, though. Yes?
Is U open?
That's a very good question. It is, or rather it will turn out to be, because we define it later, to be open. As in, we just decide U is open. But the main reason why we're doing this whole thing is that we don't know, because M is just some set. M does not know what it means to be open. So U is just some subset of M. The important thing is that it maps to something open. So the whole reason why we do this thing is that we have sets. We don't know how to deal with the sets. They can be very weird things. They don't necessarily need to be sets of points. They can be sets of functions, sets of lines, sets of whatever you want. So what we're doing is map them to Rn in some way, then look at the properties in Rn and bring them up to the object. That's what we're trying to do here to describe the shape. Right now, we're just doing the locally looks like. But we're going to do the smooth part, which means differential structure. And we cannot do it on a set. But we can do it in Rn, and then we can just, through the maps, bring up all the information. Same happens with the topological aspects, so whether something is open or closed. OK. So now that we have a chart, we can put lots of charts together, because this just tells us, if we have a chart, that one piece of M looks like Rn. We want the whole thing to look like Rn locally, so we need to cover it with charts. So we're going to define a collection of charts, which is called an atlas. And I'm going to, it's probably easy to call it something like an N atlas. So we know it's an n-dimensional thing. It's a collection So it's going to be a collection of charts, just a set of charts. We index them by some index. It doesn't have to be a discrete index. It could be a continuous index. It doesn't really matter. You may need a lot of charts, or you can put a lot of charts. We'll get back to this later. and the maps are defined such that phi I goes from UI, which is a subset of our manifold M, or to be manifold M. They all map to Rn. That's why it's an N atlas. We cannot mix and match. The whole thing needs to look like Rn. It cannot look like R2 in some places and R1 in some cases. And we require some compatibility conditions between the charts. That's where smooth happens. We're going to require three things. So first of all, the union of all of the charts is the whole thing. So the idea of the atlas is we cover the whole thing with charts. So if you put together all of these things, they cover M. Maybe they cover it more than once, it doesn't matter, but they need to cover the whole thing. Then the next thing we want is that phi I of the intersection between UI and UJ is open for all I and J. What this is telling us is that if we have two different things here, UI and UJ, this one, UI, is mapped by phi I to an open set. UJ is mapped to phi J to an open set, but this area in the middle can be mapped by phi I and by phi 2. Both of them can act on it, and we want this intersection to also be open when we map it to Rn. And finally, the transition maps which I'm about to define. The transition maps are the things that look like this, phi I composed with phi j to the minus 1 are C infinity or smooth. They're infinitely many times differentiable. And now these functions, something that's important to note, and that's why we're doing all this, phi I composed phi j to the minus 1, these are functions that go from phi j of ui intersection uj, which is a subset of Rn, to Rn. The reason why we are doing intersection is that once we map something to phi j to the minus 1, we need to also feed it to phi I, but not everything can be fed to phi I. So we need to restrict to things that are both in UJ and UI. So both things are well-defined. This is an open subset of Rn, and it maps to Rn. So this is now a map that we know how to deal with from calculus. So whether this or not is differentiable, we can find out. We cannot do that with the maps phi I themselves, because what does it mean for phi to be differentiable? How do you even take a derivative? The main problem is that when you want to take a derivative, you do something like f of x plus h minus f of x. That minus is the big problem, but really the plus for x plus h. For points on a given set, how do you add two of them? You generally cannot. So if you cannot do that, then it doesn't make sense to define derivatives the way we usually do. But if you instead map each piece to Rn, you can sum things in Rn, take the derivative, and then the number, you pull it back. So it makes sense to define things this way. So these things together, all three of them, give you an N atlas. Technically, this is what we call a smooth N atlas. This is not an important distinction for us, because we only care about differentiable manifolds. But you can do manifolds that don't care about being smooth. They just want continuous things. So you could ask that these are continuous instead of being smooth. or for some reason you only ask that they are differentiable once or twice if you want to be less restrictive. But usually we're okay with these in physics. Any questions on this definition? Okay, so we're almost there with defining manifolds. So the next thing is quite easy. At this point, we say that a set, well, let's put it this way. So a manifold is a set M together with an N atlas. And I'm going to put the subscript M so that we know it maps to this one, because sometimes we're going to use different manifolds and we need different sets of atlases. And we say that the dimension of M is N, which is the N appearing in the atlas. So if it locally looks like Rn, then we say that the dimension of the manifold is M. So that's our definition. And now I'm going to show you some examples. So the easiest example of all is M is Rn. We cover it with one chart. So the atlas is going to have the chart Rn and identity. So here we mean that the map is just the identity takes Rn to Rn. That's a nice map. It takes Rn to an open set, which is Rn. And because there's only one chart, we don't really need to worry about any of this. There is only one transition map, which is the identity, and that's smooth. There's only one UI, so the intersection with itself is itself. We already know that it's open, so this doesn't matter. UI is the set itself, so this doesn't matter. So we don't actually need to check anything. It doesn't matter whether it's smooth or not. We never actually need to check for that. So this follows the definition, and this tells us that Rn is an n-dimensional smooth manifold. I should have said same thing here. These things that we're defining are smooth manifolds. You can define things that are less generic than this. So you can see topological manifolds only require a continuous atlas. Okay, so this is kind of trivial. Let's do something less trivial. So for our next example, I'm going to do a different example than on the lecture notes. In the lecture notes, I have the sphere. I'm going to do the circle using the same idea, just because it's simple for me to draw it. Much simpler for me to draw it. So M is going to be the circle, which we usually call S1. So this is going to be the set of all the pairs x and y in R2, such that x squared plus y squared is 1. So we would like for this to be a manifold. So to do this, we need to find charts. There are many ways of finding charts for the circle. One of the ways is this one. It's what we call the stereographic projection. We're going to have two charts. The charts are going to be u plus phi plus, u minus phi minus. And I'm going to define u plus to be the set of all the points in the circle minus this one. So I'm going to remove the point 0, 1. And u minus is going to be the one without the bottom point, 0 minus 1. So as it turns out, you need at least two charts to describe the circle, which is a good thing, because you need only one chart to describe Arendt. And if you can describe something with one chart, then that something is Arendt, or at least it can be made into Arendt. And the circle is much different than a line, because it has an important property that it loops around. So we really don't want it to be the same as R1. So the way we're going to map it is through stereographic projection. The way this works is that for any point in the circle, if we look at the chart, this one, the one we removed, the top point, which is usually called the North Pole, even though it's a circle, but it makes more sense because with the sphere, you're removing the actual North Pole. We take this point and this point, we draw a line between them, and we project down on the x-axis. And this point is the one we associate to this point. So the map phi takes this point and maps it to the projection here. And this point will be mapped here. This point will be mapped here. It's actually going to be before the projection. This point is mapped here. There is a formula for this. It's in the lecture notes, the version for the sphere. But there is really is no reason to give you the details. The important thing is that we have a map that does this. The only thing we cannot map is this point itself. Because if we have only one point, we cannot talk about the line that passes through it. Every line passes through this and this. So for this point, this procedure is not well defined. So for that point, we use the inverse projection, which is defined exactly the same, but it starts from down here. So for here, we can, for each point, we can project this way. And for this point, we map it here. So you can define both charts. I'm not going to show this to you, but you can check it yourself if you want by looking at the formula from the lecture notes. You can just look at the transition functions and see that indeed they behave like you want to. So by using two charts, you're able to cover the whole circle and make into a manifold. Are there any questions about this example? It's quite annoying to actually check the transition functions, which is why I'm skipping this, because we don't have a lot of time. But if you have questions about that, just let me know. We can always do it at another lecture or put in a tutorial. OK, so next example, this is actually more interesting. For the circle, we already have an intuition that that thing is a one-dimensional geometrical shape and a smooth. It kind of looks nice and smooth. And we know we only need one parameter to describe it. The next example is, I'm going to also simplify this just because it makes less stuff for me to write, but it's exactly the same thing. So in the notes, you're going to find the projective plane. I'm going to show you the projective line. It's the same idea. Instead of doing a sphere, we did a circle because I can more easily do this. I cannot draw this, but it's just less stuff for me to write down. The projective line is an interesting example because it's not a set of points in Arendt. It's a set of weird things. So there are many ways to describe this. But one of them is the set of all lines through the origin in R2. And we need to be more specific here. What do we mean by the set of all lines through the origin? So when we have this line, and this line, and this line, and so on, so all of these things, these are all points in a set. They are distinct objects, so we can put them somewhere. But a simpler way of defining a line is this. So we can define line. We can define it by a direction. So we can look at the direction vector, and that gives us the line. Because everything that is spanned by the vector is a line. So let's call it x. So this is in R2, technically minus the zero vector. However, something we need to keep in mind is that if x prime is proportional to x, so something like this with lambda different than zero, then they give the same line. So we need to take this into account. To do this, we introduce an equivalence relation. We say that x prime is equivalent to x if they are proportional to each other. So x prime equals lambda x with lambda different than zero. So we're going to consider this to be equivalent. So in picture form, what we're saying is this vector specifies a line, because we can just look at this. But this vector specifies the same line, because it's just the same thing, but in the other direction and longer. But the line does not care about that, as long as it's not zero, because then it doesn't generate anything. So at this point, we can mathematically describe the projective line, which we usually call P1R. This is because it's the one-dimensional projective thing. And this is going to be the set of all equivalence classes of vectors. So I don't know if you've seen this notation before, but you can think of this as being R2 minus the zero vector. And this whole thing is quotiented by the equivalence class, by the equivalence relation. But this is just a notation for the set of equivalence classes. So we have the set of the equivalence classes of x, y, such that x, y is in R2 minus 0. And the equivalence class itself, in case you've not seen things like this before, the equivalence class of a certain vector is a set itself, and it's the set of all the things equivalent to it. So either way, we ended up with this projective line being a set of sets. either we think of it as a set of lines and the lines themselves are a set of points, or you have sets of vectors and you do the same thing. And in fact, you actually end up with the same exact description because these equivalence classes are all the vectors, say, proportional to this. So they are all the points. If you identify a vector with the point at the end of the vector, they're all the points on this line. So this is a very weird thing. It's not just your nice circle that's just a subset of R2. This is something that is just some weird set of other sets. So the reason why we are going to call it a line is that it has dimension one as a manifold. But to give it a dimension, we need to give it an atlas. So the next step is to figure out the atlas that we need for this. Any questions while I set up the boards? Okay, so for the charts, let's see. We're going to need two charts. So I'm going to call it U1 and U2. And they need to be something that take an equivalence class as input and spit out one real number. So we're going to define them like this. Phi1 takes, well, first of all, I need to tell you what U1 is. So U1 is going to be the set of all the equivalence classes of X1. I'm just going to call them X and Y. We're going to choose them so that X is different than 0. And U2 is going to be the same thing, but with Y different than 0. And then Phi1 is going to map the equivalence class of X and Y to a number, and the number that we get is Y over X. The reason why I require that X is different than 0 is that I want to divide by X. So I can only do that if X is different than 0. And the reason why I'm doing this is that this map acts on equivalence classes. We need to make sure that it does not depend on the representative that we choose. So if I choose X and Y, or I choose something proportional to it, I should get the same answer. But if I give this 3X, 3Y instead of X and Y, you get the same thing, because the 3 cancels out with the division. Same thing for Phi2. We're going to, this time, divide by Y. And you can check relatively easily that the image of each one of these things is an open set in Rn, because it's actually the whole line. Because here, Y can be anything you want. So if you fix X, say, to be 1, and then you look at all possible Ys, then you get the whole real line. So the image of these maps is going to be the real line, which is open. The only thing left to check, which I'm not going to do because we don't have time, is that if you do the transition functions, they behave the way you want. So all of these things, if you feel like trying them, you can. I'm going to give you time at the tutorial to just test any of these things. So all of these things that I'm telling you, this is the chart, that's the atlas. I haven't actually showed you that this is an atlas. I just said this is a collection of charts. At most, you can see that it covers the whole thing, but I didn't show you any of the other things. So you can do this at tutorial if you don't trust me, which is always a good idea. The last thing I wanted to show you, this is a very powerful way of creating new manifold. is by using something which is called the implicit function theorem. If we have a function that goes from some open subset of Rn to Rm, and the Jacobian matrix for this thing has constant rank, So first of all, this must be smooth. And the Jacobian matrix has non-zero rank, really full rank. Otherwise, things get tricky. So it needs to have full rank, which in this case is, we're also going to assume that M is less than N. So we're mapping something bigger to something smaller. So full rank, which in this case is equal to M, because it's the smallest thing. So if this is the situation, then F to the minus 1 of the set that only has the zero vector in Rm is a manifold. It's smooth manifold. The problem with this theorem is that the theorem just tells you that this is true. It doesn't tell you what the manifold is, what the charts are. But I'm going to show you an example of this. So we'll use this to look at the same thing. Implicit function theorem. But the implicit function theorem tells you example, for the circle, instead of looking at it as we have, we can just say that it's the set of points where x squared plus y squared minus 1 equals 0. And so we can think of this as being this set where the function is defined as this. So the circle is the set of points where this function is 0. So you can think of it as being this. And this function is a nice smooth function. And if you look at the Jacobian matrix, it's going to look like this. It's a 2x1 matrix or 1x2, depending on your convention. And it has 2x and 2y as the components. But because we're on the circle, we are really looking at, as the open set, U, we are looking at R2 minus 0. Because we're looking, in any case, at points on the circle. So we're never going to be at the origin. If we are not at 0, then this thing is never both 0. Because either x is 0 or y is 0. You cannot have both of them. So the rank of this matrix is always 1 or 2. Well, actually, it cannot have 2 because it's a 2x1 matrix. So the rank of J is always 1 because we're excluding the 0, 0 case. So the theorem tells us that the circle is a manifold, which is not very helpful because we knew already. But I wanted to show you how exactly you can use this theorem to come up with the charts. The implicit function theorem tells you that if I have something like this, I have a function of two variables being equal to 0, and the Jacobian has full rank, then it tells you that you can write one of the variables as a function of the other, at least locally. So locally, we can write something like y equals f of x. So that's what you do with a circle when you say, OK, so I have x squared plus y squared minus 1 equals 0. So locally, you can say something like y equals the square root of 1 minus x squared. This is not true for the whole circle. You cannot do the whole circle this way, but you can do part of it. And then the other thing you can do is in other places you do y is minus the square root of 1 minus x squared. Or you could do the other thing and say that x is the square root of 1 minus y squared, and so on. So you can always write one variable in terms of the other locally. That's what the theorem tells you. In the more general case, where you have n and m, it tells you you can write m of the variables in terms of the remaining ones. So with the time we have left, I wanted to actually show you what the chart is. So if you want to use this way of describing the circle, it turns out you need at least 4 charts. So we can do something like this. Because we can write one of the variables in terms of the other, one of them becomes the parameter. So let's think of it this way. If we're looking at the circle, let's just look at this part. So this is the part where y is greater than 0. So we can always say that y is the square root of 1 minus x squared. If we do this, we're essentially saying that if I give you x, that automatically tells me what y is. So x itself is a coordinate. X is a parameter that tells me where I am on the circle, on this part of the circle. It's not a global one, because I could be at the bottom of the circle. If I tell you x is 0, that doesn't tell you whether I'm here or here. But if I already tell you I'm up here, don't worry, then x tells me everything I need to know. So the first chart that we're going to use is u1. And I don't want to write the whole thing. It's just going to be this part of the circle. And the map phi1 is going to take x and y and just give us x. So we use that as our coordinate. And if I look at the bottom of the circle, so this is going to be our u2, is just going to be this area of the circle. Same thing, now y is minus the square root of 1 minus x squared, and phi2 of xy is still going to be x, because that's enough to know where I am on this area. And by the way, if you want to invert this function, if you want to do phi to the minus 1 of x, this is going to give us a point on the circle, which is x square root of 1 minus x squared, because that's what we have here, y equals 1 minus x squared. So this expression here is actually the expression from the inverse of the chart, rather than the chart itself. And here, phi 2 to the minus 1 of x is x minus square root of 1 minus x squared. Now, we have a problem. And the problem is that if you overlap these two things, they don't cover the whole circle. Because this excludes these points where y equals 0, and this excludes the point where y equals 0. The reason why we need to exclude them is that we want the map to map to an open set in Rn. But this map, if I let x go from minus 1 included to 1 included, maps to a closed set. So I cannot do that. So I need to exclude the endpoints. So these two maps on their own, they don't work. That's why I need at least 4 charts in this case. So in addition to this, I can define 2 other regions of the circle. And they're going to be these ones. This is the one region 3, where we write x as a function of y. So this time, the parameter is y, so the map phi3 takes x, y, and it maps it to y. And then region 4 is going to be the left side of the circle. Now x is minus the square root of 1 minus y squared. And so phi 4 of xy is y. And the inverses are going to behave just the same. So this of y is going to be square root of 1 minus y squared y. Phi 4 y to the minus 1 is minus the square root and y. Now, all of these things do cover the whole circle because this one covers the point here they were excluded. This one covers the point here they were excluded. So now you have four different charts, and you can test that all of those things are true. You can check the intersections, which are going to be things like these. They're going to be quarter circles. You can intersect 3 with 1 or 3 with 2, but not 3 and 4. And then you can do 1 with 3. Well, you just do the same thing backwards, really. So you can look at all the intersections, and we can easily just start checking 1. They actually all turn out to be the same. Say we want to do 5, 3 compose with phi 1 to the minus 1. We're going to feed it one parameter. Just to avoid confusion with x and y, I'll call it t. This is going to give us phi 3 of phi 1 to the minus 1. We say this is going to have the first thing there, t, and then the square root of 1 minus t squared. And phi 3 just selects the second entry of this thing. So it is the square root of 1 minus t squared. Moreover, because I'm working the intersection here, the parameter t cannot be anything, because in section 3, the parameter goes, the r parameter can be everything, but for section 1, y is greater than 0. Our parameter t is essentially y, so t must be between 0 and 1. And this function is a smooth function between 0 and 1. At 1, it potentially has problems with this being a square root, but we're excluding the point, so everywhere in between, this is actually a nice-looking function. And if you were to do all of the other intersections, they actually all always look like this function, at most with a minus sign in front. And you're going to change this to be 0, 1, or minus 1 to 0, depending on where you are. But other than that, all intersections look the same, and they're all smooth functions. So at least for this, I actually showed you the whole procedure, just with some minor details skipped. Any questions so far? Okay, we just have a few minutes left, but there's one main thing I want to tell you. We covered a bit less than I was hoping, so we're going to finish this stuff for the next lecture. But there is one important thing I want to tell you. I kind of lied to you. The definition of a manifold is not what I told you it was. There's a problem. I told you before that the circle was given by the stereographic projection maps. Now I gave you four charts that describe the circle. So we have two circles. And the way I told you things, I say this, a manifold is a set with a set of charts. I have two different circles. They are distinct things. So we have circle 1. That's going to be the set S1. And the atlas is going to be the stereographic. And then I have S1 with an atlas A prime. And this time, we have those four charts. So phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, phi 4. it will not be great to have two different ways of defining the same object. That's kind of annoying. There's a way to fix this. The way to fix this is defining equivalences of atlases. So we say that A is equivalent to A prime as atlases if A union A prime is still an atlas. Essentially, what we're saying is that if I look at the charts in A, the charts in A prime, I put them together and make one big chart that has all the charts inside, they are still compatible. So those three properties up there, they still work with all of the charts. So for example, a stereographic projection covers most of the circle but the top point and all of the circle but the bottom point. Those overlap with these four. On the overlaps, they need to be compatible and satisfy all these conditions. If they do, then they're still describing the same thing. So if you really want to define a manifold, we say that a manifold is a set M with what we call a maximal atlas. A maximal atlas is an atlas that cannot be extended. So essentially, it contains all equivalent atlases. So the actual circle is not this one or this one. It's a circle with an atlas that contains this, and all possible other weird things that you might want to do. So for example, I can decide that I don't like this set. I want to split it and actually do this and this separately from this. And then I also do the one that contains both. And this is still compatible because I'm just restricting smaller things. And I can split it up in however many places I want. Staying for the stereographic projection, I said north and south. I can do east and west. Or north and west. It doesn't have to be opposite points. So I can do all sorts of weird things. So you can imagine that this atlas here, the maximum one, is huge. It has a ton of stuff in it. It is not even discrete. So you cannot even imagine this thing, which is why, in practice, when you want to define something, you just do something like this. You just find one chart, one atlas that's good enough, and then any other atlas that works the same, that's included, but you don't have to write it down. Otherwise, we're never going to finish. If I had to actually write the circle with writing out all the atlas, we'll be here forever, which is not great because we're already over time. Yes?
So how many maximal atlases does a circle have?
There's only one maximal atlas. That's why it's maximal. Oh, I see what you mean. How many different maximal atlases? Well, the circle itself only has one. If you have a different maximal atlas, it means it's not compatible. That means it's a different manifold. So a maximal atlas defines a manifold. Because the union of all the things gives you the set, the atlas gives you the atlas. So every distinct maximal atlas gives you a distinct manifold.
So like on the set of points that have like distance one from the origin, I could have like that being different manifolds.
Yes, this is a very good point. Sets are just a list of things. So when I say this thing, I say, okay, so this is the circle, it's the set of all points. And you look at this and you have a lot of assumptions about that object, which you shouldn't have. You should not have assumptions about this thing. Because if you just look at this as a set, this and the line are the same thing. Because they are just a set of continuous points. They are both the same well, let's use these as R, as sets. Not as manifolds, because they have different structures, but as sets, this has continuously many points and cardinality of the continuum, so does this. And in fact, it's the same as R2, which is what you will call a plane. So just because it's R2, it does not mean that it's a two-dimensional object. When you think of R2 as a two-dimensional thing, you are assuming a ton of stuff about R2. Specifically, you're thinking of R2 as a two-dimensional vector space. But R2 is not necessarily that. Yes?
When you say that they're the same as sets, do you mean there's a continuous map between them? What?
It doesn't have to be continuous, because we are getting rid of all the notion about continuity. So same as sets, just mean that there is an invertible mapping. So this essentially, this invertible map, you just say you can relabel things. So if I have this circle, every point, you can just map it to Rn instead, to R instead. There's a way to do it. It's not always obvious how to do this, but you can do this. The simplest one that I have is the interval minus 1 to 1 is the same as R. For this one, I can actually give you the function. So the function, you can actually use the arctangent. I probably need to adjust for pi. But the point is, you can use something like the arctangent, which is a function that behaves like this. It never reaches the extremes, but it gets arbitrarily close. And as inputs, it takes the whole real line. Probably 10 inch is actually a better option. It does exactly what we want. So 10 inch is an invertible map that goes from R to minus 1 to 1, points excluded. So you can use that to relabel things between this set and this set. And this is actually one great example, because it shows you another assumptions that you make about things. When you look at this, you think of it as a small, nice thing, and this is a big thing. But they're actually the same thing. This is worse, because this is a continuous map. And in fact, this is a smooth map. They are the same as manifolds. For things like this, is OK, these are the same as sets, but if you add the extra structure, they are very different. These two things, they are very same thing as manifolds. So this means that just because this is an interval, it does not mean it's any smaller than this. If you want to define sizes between things, you need extra structure. So if you start adding metrics on stuff, then things are different. But until you do something like that, these two are the same thing. Because this notion of manifold does not know what distance means. That's another thing that comes from the fact that you can add and subtract points in R. And then you can say, OK, so I have a distance between these two points. That gives you an idea of size. But a manifold in general does not have an idea of size. So when we look at R and minus 1, 1 as manifolds, without thinking of them as actual structures that are embedded in R itself, so you forget that R is a vector space, pretty much, then they're the same. No notion of this is smaller than this. It's not. And that's because you are excluding the endpoints. So you can always think, I stretch it out and stretch it out, and eventually it looks the same as this. Yes?
So giving a maximal atlas, is it like equivalent to giving some topology in space?
Yes. So we didn't talk about this because we don't necessarily care too much about the topological things. But so I mentioned at some point, it was asked whether the sets in the charts are open. I don't know how much you know about topology, but a topology is essentially a way of assigning open sets. I give you a set, and I tell you this subset of this set are open. You just decide and say these ones are open, and they need to satisfy some properties. If you take the union of open things, they must be open, the intersection still open, and so on. and the set itself must be open. There are some axioms to satisfy, but I can just tell you, these are the open sets, this is the object. So for a manifold, you just say, okay, so you look at the charts, the sets U in the charts, those are open sets. So if you do that, that gives you a topology to the manifold. Yes?
So since minus 1, 1 and R are the same as sets, if I include the endpoints in minus 1, 1, would that make it bigger than R?
That's a good point. It depends on the level at which you're looking at. So if you look at, probably cannot see here, if you look at minus 1 to 1 with the endpoints included, as manifolds, they are different. They are very different because this is a different kind of manifold. This is called a manifold with boundary, while R doesn't have a boundary. So obviously they're different because they have two different properties. But as sets, this is the same as minus 1 to 1. I should probably use a different symbol for as sets. I'm going to put an S subscript when they are the same as sets. They are the same because they both have the same cardinality. It's, don't have a map in mind for that, but you can still make it work. There is a way of doing this, I just don't remember it off the top of my head. So you can always say that our sets are the same. So this is important because we often think of these sets as having special structures just because of where they live. But if you forget about where they live, which means you forget about the inherited structure, you just think of them as, this is the object, I want to add structure to it, then these two things are the same. So you can make this into a manifold without boundary, or a manifold with boundary. Same for this, if you want to, this is a manifold with boundary. You just need to tell me what the charts are. And sure, it would be weird, everyone is going to hate you, but you can do it.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because naively I would assume that I could describe minus 1, 1 closed as minus 1, 1 open, union, minus 1, union, 1.
You can do that, but again, you're assuming things about this set. So when you do all these things, that's kind of in the implicit function theorem. I think when you do the implicit function theorem, you are assuming that the topology comes from the bigger space, because you have f to the minus 1 of this thing. This is a subset of Rn, or Rn. When you do this, it inherits all of the structure from this. So it's going to have the topology that comes from this. So if this is the circle, it's actually the circle. It has the topology of a circle. So doing things this way gives them the induced topology, which is very helpful. But the circle has a set of points. If I just tell you, I have this set of points, I want to make it into a manifold, then you can do it in a bunch of different ways. I told you when I gave you the stereographic projection, I said we need two charts because if I give you only one chart, there's going to be Rn. I can give you only one chart for the circle. Maybe not right this moment. I need to think about it for a bit. But you can find a single chart for the circle. And if you find a single chart for the circle, what I meant by it is Rn is that it's the same geometrical object as R. As structure geometrically would be the same. This is an important distinction that I think it's difficult to make just because of the way we used to think about things. But sets are just sets. You start with sets and then you add extra stuff on top. That's why we say a manifold is a set with something. All of the structure that this thing has is in here. Other than what's in here, it doesn't have anything else. So if I don't tell you how to measure lengths in M, assume that you cannot measure lengths in M until I tell you how to do that. Yes?
I just want to revisit what you wrote with the intervals. I mean, as sets, they are different, right? The left-hand side.
Yes, so. Yeah, so different means, so we have, this is, same as it's also true for manifolds. We have two notions that are different. One is being equal, and the other one being equivalent. So equal means they are actually exactly the same object. Then yes, these two things are different.
Yep.
That's why this is not an equal, it's an congruence thing. But as sets, they are the same thing in the sense that they are the same number of elements. And I can map from one to the other.
So for sets, they're not even homeomorphic. Like, what, in what sense?
No, for sets,
yes.
Equivalence relation is bijections, and for manifolds, it's diffeomorphisms. And for topological spaces, it's homeomorphisms.
Yes. So when you say they're not homomorphic, you're right, but you already put some structure on them.
But there's an object on the left-hand side that's not in the right-hand side. So how can...
Okay. So...
Bijection.
Okay. So are you... Well, let's check this. Are you okay with saying that these two things are pretty much the same?
Yeah, it's literally that. Literally.
Okay, so you say they have the same like cardinality.
I'm just changing names to things. So I can say this is 0, 1, or I decide, okay, so I'm going to call this 1 minus 1, and I'm going to call this one still 1. I'm just changing names. This one, it looks weird to you because you... When you see the closed bracket, you are thinking this thing as the closed thing that's closed in R. But by doing that, you are adding extra structure on this object. You are thinking of this as living in R, and as living in R, it inherits extra information. So to think of that these are the same assets, you need to forget about the extra information. Because it's stuff that you are assuming that you're not supposed to. Because I just told you this is a set. It's a weird thing. It takes a bit to get used to. But it turns out to be important because that's how you can make sense of the structure that we're adding on things. So the whole point, oh, by the way, we're way over time, so if you want to go eat, feel free to leave. I'm not going to be offended. But the whole point of this thing that we're doing is we want to add structure intrinsically to things. Instead of just relying on, okay, this lives in Rn, so I can just pull down all the stuff from Rn and I give structure to things. There are a few reasons why we want to do this. First of all, if you want to add structure to the projective line, the projective plane, this is the way to do it because they don't live in R2. It's not a set of points, it's a set of equivalence classes. It's a set of weird things. The other thing is that, say, in physics, you want to describe space-time, and like, philosophically speaking, space-time doesn't live anywhere else. Space-time is the thing where everything else lives in. So you would like to add structure to it from within and not say, well, space-time actually lives in R5, and in R5 we have this topology and it brings it down. So you would like things to be more interesting. Plus, this way you allow for things that cannot possibly live in R5. So for example, the projective plane, which is a two-dimensional manifold, cannot be embedded in R3. Same thing for the Klein bottle. I know you've all seen the Klein bottles things. Those are not actually Klein bottles. They don't really work. You cannot actually have the Klein bottle as a 2D object that lives in 3D. So those are all tricks to kind of give you an idea of how it works, but it's not actually the object. Because it kind of goes through itself, and at some point it looks like it's not continuous, but it is. Yes?
You can define a manifold and charts in it without embedding it into a higher space.
Yes. Well, that's what we did. So if you look at the projective line, which I don't think is visible anymore, I didn't embed it into anything. I just said this is a set of equivalence classes. They don't live in any place. It just is a set of sets. And then I gave you charts. And then I didn't show you that they were actually an atlas. But if you actually check it's an atlas, then that's it. I made a manifold. Yes?
Can you elaborate a little bit more on what is the difference between saying two spaces are equivalent on the manifold level and on a topological level?
I wish I could, but I didn't have time to tell you about diffeomorphisms. So I will be able to tell you at the next lecture. So when we have sets, equivalent means there's an invertible map between them. When you have extra structure, you need a way of saying this structure is the same.
Okay.
So that's going to be you have a homomorphism or a diffeomorphism. And we need to define what that means.
So that's like
so for vector spaces is you have an invertible linear map between them.
Yeah.
Which is what we call an isomorphism. So isomorphisms are essentially, if you look at category theory stuff, they are a way of mapping objects into each other in an invertible way. So if you can do that, then not only you can rename things, but you can also rename the structure. So when I add these, you look at these two sets, okay, so they're the same assets. Then I start telling you these things are actually groups. And then I tell you, okay, so this the group is the addition modulo 2. And then I say, okay, so 0 plus 0 is 0, 0 plus 1 is 1, 1 plus 1 is 0. And I tell you this is a group, the product is the actual thing. So you have 1 times 1, minus 1, and so on. Then I map them by keeping the group structure intact, and that's an isomorphism. So we would like to do the same thing for manifolds, but we cannot because I didn't have time to tell you how.
So it's homeomorphisms versus continuous, invertible.
Yes. Yes. And the most general thing you always need is an invertible thing. So at the very, for two things to be the same object, they need to, well, equivalent objects. At the very least, they need to be the same assets. If they're not the same assets, there's no way they're the same as anything else. So if I give you something that has two elements and I give you R, they cannot be equivalent. There's no way they're equivalent because one is two elements, the other one is infinitely many.
Could you give an example of two spaces that are homeomorphic but are not diffeomorphic?
Sure. So again, this is assuming extra stuff. But you can think of these two things as being homeomorphic but not diffeomorphic. As embedded in R2. So I'm just looking at the circle or the square. They are homeomorphic because you can continuously deform one into the other. They are not diffeomorphic because of these edges. But that said, if I forget about the fact that this thing has edges, because the edges come from the fact that it lives in Rn, in R2, in our case. But if I forget about that and just look at this as a set, then this as a set is equivalent to this as a set, which means it's actually diffeomorphic to this, if I add the right structure on this. That's the distinction that I'm talking about here. So it's always when you look at things, you're always adding extra structure on them if they live in R2. And you can essentially, anytime you have two things that are the same as sets, you can make them into being equivalent to anything you want. If this one is a smooth manifold, then this one can be a smooth manifold. You just steal the smooth manifold structure from here. You just say, okay, so I'm going to rename everything in here so that it has the same names as this. And then I say, well, that's a structure. I'll just take it from there. So you can make anything you want into anything else that's on the other set, as long as they have the same set structure. I know this is a weird point that takes a while to digest. It's important to know, in the end, it's not going to be terrible because you're still going to really think of the circle as a circle. Like, I know that I can make this into anything I want, but that's weird. Like, this is a circle. We all agree that this is a circle. It has the nice properties that the circles usually has. But it's good to have the idea that that's just a set because it helps understand why we're doing all this. We're doing all this because a set on its own doesn't have any geometrical information at all. And that only comes from something like being a manifold. So that's the whole point of this thing. We're defining these things so that things make sense. And so that the notion of a circle as just a drawing actually makes mathematical sense. Because we know that's a circle, but we need to define it mathematically to see what is the structure that makes it so that you turn around and you get back to itself. Yes?
The way you have defined manifolds, is it sufficient to then say that the way you define smooth manifolds, is it sufficient to say that then they are topological manifolds as well?
Yes. So you need the extra assumption, but actually, yes, because topological manifolds are the same as what I've said. The definition there, instead of saying C infinity, they say C1. There are two different definitions of manifolds, topological manifolds. So depending on where you look, it may look different. Sometimes people say, okay, so you have a topological set So the in that case, you already say that the charts are open sets of the manifold, and then you require the transition maps to be continuous. But you can also just use the transition maps directly. So you can forget about the whole topology of the thing. You just put the charts on it, and then you define the topology as being, OK, so all of the open sets are the charts and the unions and the intersections.
So the way you have defined, you have not mentioned that U is an open set, right? But is it like, does it come out that, oh, U is actually an open set?
No, you define it. You just say, so later by definition, I say that, so the open sets of M are the set of all the UIs, well, are generated by this. So let's say generated. It's called the base for the topology. You have a set of basic open sets, and you build all the other ones out of it. So for example, for R, you say the open intervals are my base of open sets. And then you can take union of them. They're still open. You intersect them. They're still open, and so on. So that's how you define the topology. You just say, OK, all the charts that are given, all of the sets UI are open. And that's just how you define it. And it turns out it's consistent. And it works. And if you do that, then the charts that you're doing are actually going to be those charts. They go from U to Rn, and the thing is open. They're actually continuous maps. But you don't know that a priori. You just add it on top. If you follow this approach, and as I said, there are different approaches where you start with the topology and then do things. So for example, you start with a circle. With the topology of the circle as a topological object itself, and then you give it charts in such a way that the charts are continuous. You can do that too. I prefer this because that's what you do for smooth manifolds anyway, and then it works for topological ones as well. Plus, this way you induce the structure from the atlas itself. Otherwise, I need to look at the circle. I already need to have a topology for it. And then I add the chart on top of that. So that's extra pieces of information I need.